Mr. Larry Gaines, Reel 4.
Wasn't there another case where you had to turn out against political demonstrators? In Bengal?
Ah, yes. Well, that... you see, now, when we went to Bengal, I mean, we don't see nothing on paper. You hear it by word of mouth. The rumour gets around. Somebody, we're going to Bengal, somebody, students or something, causing trouble, which apparently it seemed that if there was trouble in there, it would be started by the students in that area. And we were under the impression they were shooting up government officials' places or something, you know. We eventually get to Dhaka and get off of the boat, fully prepared, rifles, you know, one up the breach and kind of business. And when we stepped ashore, there was thousands of these Bengalis either side of the main street waving little Union Jacks. To us, I said, it seemed rather comical at the time when we were expecting bullets. And we just marched through the bazaar, no trouble at all. But after being there a while, we had to go out what we call, doing it again, demonstration marches. You know, show that you're in control of the place. And we'd march in throughout the bazaars, band and drums playing. Of course, this was a great thing for the Bengalis, band and drums, bashing away. But you had to go into the area to get to know these Bengalis, talk to them. Not like we've been used to, our chawwallas and whatnot, you know, sitting on the verandas talking. You didn't get any of that in Bengal. You couldn't, not in this particular area we were in, but in places like Calcutta, which is all in that area, there was more English spoken than anywhere else in India. Because we found with the few Bengalis we met, they spoke English fluently. But the trouble there was, you could tell by the atmosphere, you didn't see much of them. But what you did see, you could sense, watch them. And they were students, you know. They could see that our force was a little bit stronger than theirs. They better not start cutting up rough or something like that, because they knew we had the strength on air side kind of business, so we didn't have any trouble direct.
But you could feel an atmosphere of tension.
But there was that, there was that atmosphere of tension, you know. You would say, well, I don't know. If you were out and you saw any of these particular students, they were always in fours and sixes. But for some unknown reason, they wouldn't come in contact with you. Even the restaurant we used to go in, the OK restaurant, was the only place I know of in Dhaka where they could go for meals, and they were partitioned off. That was us here with their eggs, bacon, cups of tea. And on the other side of this partition, you could smell this strong flavour of, which I loved very much, but I didn't want to embarrass myself by going to get a plateful, was curry. I'm a lover of curry. And you could smell this curry coming over, curry and rice. The students next door. See, they couldn't sit with us. They were always separated.
What did you think to the Bengalis?
Well, I rather liked them, the people I met. They were very... very nice people, the Gay family, the ones I got to know. We got to know them quite well, my mate myself. And I got to know them so well that I fell to the job of teaching the daughter. I said a few dance steps on the floor there, but anything to make entertainment. Used to put on the radiogram record player thing there, and we used to dance around and what have you, until one day, because the Bengalis, as far as families are concerned, are very strict. I mean, father won't let daughter out of his sight one second. Well, you can't blame him for that. So it was arranged, unbeknown to myself, that this chap, Harry, all had English names, who was a friend of the family, he was a Bengali, was to meet me this particular evening outside the restaurant when I came down from camp. And we got in this gharry, shut both doors, so you're out of sight of anybody, and away we went. Well, he was taking me through the bazaars, which normally were out of bounds, which I didn't know. And we went to this, his house, where he lived actually, and it was a wonderful place inside. And when you see all these masses of roads and streets and all packed in like it was, to go into a place and see all this coloured cushion and a divan and everything, carpet, you thought you were back home, but it was all Eastern style, everything was on the floor, you know. And in the middle of the floor stood my dancing pupil. And of course, we had what you call high tea, and we went up on the roof, because out there, flat roofs, and it was a hot night. And we used to go up and sit on these flat roofs, put the record on, dance around if you want to. And that was that. Well, then shortly we were due to leave Dhaka. Our time there was ended. And wasn't worried really, because there wasn't much there, you know, we could do. Not like the other stations. So we were looking forward to getting back to our next station, which was Selcot. But I went into the barracks one morning and the company commander called me across. I went into his office and he put a piece of paper on the table and said, "Read that." So I read it, and it was an application form, the Bengal Police Force. So I read it down. It had everything there as if I'd filled it in myself. You know, any scar on my jaw, or colour your eyes, your hair, height. And all it required was my signature on the bottom.
Was that there? Was the signature?
No, that's all it required. So, before I had a chance to think of it, at the time it seemed really glamorous, you know, motorbike, 45 on your hip, tearing around the bazaars, very attractive. So I was like, no. I'd have a bungalow, half a dozen servants. It was all rose, you know. And while I was thinking all this, the company commander sat in front of me, and he was peeling this application off like a banana skin.
Tearing out.
Yeah. He said, "That's what I think of it." He said, "Gaines," he said, "you're in the Bengal Police Force." He said, "Go on," he says, "get out." He said, "before I change my mind." So that was that. And I'm glad in the way, because I didn't want to tie myself down.
So who'd filled in this application from?
This daughter of the restaurant. She had ideas, unbeknown to me. Because I didn't attach any importance to it, you know. It was company, and I thought they were black. I mean, she was real Bengali. I mean, they weren't white or half white. But she was a very attractive girl in their colour.
And was this the first you'd heard about this police force business?
Yes, I didn't know anything about it.
I'm sure she'd done it with the object of getting married.
Well, I think that was the answer, because I'd seen a chap while we were there one evening, kind of a social evening. This sergeant walked in, Bengal Police Force, English, and he came in with his wife, Bengali, and she was a size, and you know, four children, they were all black, you know, little Bengalis. And I said to my mate, I said, good God. I said, very nice. I said, but not for me, you know. That's all we attached it, because the next thing that cropped up was this letter. And when I saw this letter, I could visualise this sergeant coming in with his family. Oh, I said, no.
What was the name of this Bengali girl?
Doris. Dorothy.
Can you remember a second name?
Gay. They were very nice people. I liked them, especially her mother. They'd never see us go without, you know. And
were both her mother and father Indians?
Oh, yes, they were.
Because Gay is not an Indian name.
Ah, I know, nor is Harry. But this relative that took me down to bazaar, I was to call him Harry. They all had English names. Oh, yes, you couldn't go by that. Her name was Dorothy, and her surname was Gay. And I did make inquiries quite some time ago. Apparently, senior father, he'd passed on, and the family had split up. That was years after. Don't know what happened. I mean, they had those big swamps, didn't they? In Bengal, tidal waves washed them all out. They may not have been there, they may have been in Calcutta, but it was just one of those things that we travelled throughout India, we met, we left behind, you know.
Was this the only instance in which you visited the home of an Indian, or did you go into the home of any other Indians?
No, I think that's the only time really. That private home, you know, like that. We had no cause to go into any, unless it was a large restaurant, you know. But,
when you were in Dhaka, and there was this trouble with the students, were you allowed to go out in the bazaar by yourselves?
No, you had to be in twos. Twos upwards. And, well, the only thing was, if you went down the bazaar, you were just out for devilment. You felt, oh, well, come on, let's have a bit of excitement, you know. And two or three or four of you go down the bazaar. And when I say down the bazaar, they're narrow, very narrow. Where you go through alleys, more or less. They're all alleys. What? And we just go wandering around, you know, and suddenly we'd see a place and we'd say to Jack, what's that over there? And we learnt then over these, what they used to have for the troops, you know, these brothels there. So I says, oh, not for us, I said, bear left, and we went up through the bazaar. But it so happened one of the lads passed a crag, well, I don't know what he said, but something he shouldn't have said. And when we turned the next lane, there was about seven or eight Bengalis, student types, at the end of this passage. And when we turned round, I thought to myself, well, what have we walked into? There was another half a dozen, the end we came in, so they knew we were coming through. But it so happened, at that particular time, we were told to wear, for walking out dress, we had to wear sidearms, which was a belt and bayonet. That was the old Long Bainish, you know. And well, we looked up. Well, there's only one way out, and that was a bit high. You couldn't reach it. It was a flat roof, you know. And they were closing in on us. I said, I want to talk about a thriller. What happens here? And this lot got quite near us. And then all of a sudden, old Bert, poor old Bertie Lehman, panicked. And he whipped this bayonet out. And stuck with this Bengali, but it just pierced his arm enough to draw blood, you know. And within a second, we were on our own.
Were they armed? Did they have sticks or anything?
No, they had nothing. Within the time of him doing that with that bone, we were by ourselves. There wasn't a soul in sight. So we didn't wait to think or work it out. We just took off, you know. Got to the main street, dived in the first tonga that come along and shot back to camp. That was our only experience of, you know, we'd nearly walked into trouble. Because if anything could come of that, if they had been students, they could have made something of it. Because we were in an area we shouldn't be in.
Did you? So you obviously didn't report it when you got back?
No, no. No, we kept quiet.
Where were you quartered in Dhaka? Because was there a cantonment there?
Yes, it was a thatch camp. Thatch area, double deckers. You know, two floors from the camp. But we did stay at the college when we first moved in, a big white building, big white marble. Wonderful place, right beside the racetrack. Bengali's racetrack. And that was a fascinating building. You know, a staircase about 15 foot wide. Marvellous thing going up round this building. We stayed there for a week. And I always remember my week there because we had to do our turn on sentry go, on guard. And I was doing 2 hours on, and you're in this big white square entrance, and all of a sudden there was all this buzzing around your head, you know, because you had a terrific strong light over your head, bulb. It was just buzzing about, and you looked up, and there's these egg-shaped, they were, flying round and round this light, you know.
Insects.
No, it wasn't an insect. It was a beetle. We used to call them something, beetle.
What did you call them?
They were flying around there. Well, can I tell you what
yes,
it was?
Yes, why not?
Well, we used to call them piss beetles. See, because as they hit anything, look out. And I'll say they were as big as eggs. And you used to stand there with your rifle, you kept trying to jab them, you know, and eventually you would. They'd run into your rifle because they were blind with light, and they'd fall down. And the floor used to be smothered, because as they fell down, you made sure of them, you know.
So they used to squirt a liquid out, did they?
Yes. Well, same as lizards. You get lizards, you know, that used to get on. You lay in your bed. This is up the hills. You lay in your bed and all of a sudden you'd see a lizard come from out somewhere and it'd crawl up round. It's all right while you left it alone, but if you touched it and it wet on you, you'd get blisters come up straight away on your hand.
Did you get the same blisters from these piss people?
Well, I didn't, because I made sure I didn't get caught.
But if the liquid from these beetles
but
came
I,
in,
yes, they
they'd
did,
also make...
But they weren't effective. It was up and down if you brushed it off. You know, if you brushed it off quick, wiped it off, there was no after effects. They were a sizer.
You've told me about the occasions when you were called out against political demonstrators. Could we go on next to the type of training which you had? Did you have the normal soldiers type of training, like square bashing and so on, and rifle drill as a bandsman?
Oh, yes, you had that. I mean, we, as musicians, had our own thing. You know,
musical practice.
Practice, retreat beating, marching up and down, you know, playing, march up and down. And, of course, the companies, they had their drill. Like, say, once a week, the RSM would have a parade. You'd have an RSM's parade, an adjutant's parade, a CO's parade. Well, the RSM would have his parade, and he would have the whole battalion on parade. Now, this particular spot, it was in Salcot. And whenever the RSM had a parade, I used to be what they called orderly drummer. I used to have to report to the RSM on parade. And I would stand close behind him with my drum. And the battalion would be in line. And when I say battalion, them days, you know, battalion was over 1,000 strong. And they would be in line right across the square with fixed bayonets. And I'd stand behind him with the drum. He would give the cautionary word of command. They were standing at ease. He'd bring them to attention. Then he would give the order, battalion will slope arms. Then he'd bellow out, slope. And a signal with his finger behind, I'd hit the drum. And as they slope arms, see three movements, they come up each time I tap the drum. And those 1,000 men, see those bayonets come up, not one man, just for the tap of a drum, nothing else, no voice. To me, I mean, all on my own, it was a marvellous, marvellous thing. And then he'd get parade marching past. Excuse me. You get a parade marching past in companies, in line, you see, by company. And I'm on my own still. Well, because I got to know in time, but as they come marching past, when you first start, you get in the habit of watching their feet. See, as the company come up, you're tapping away, and you watch their feet go by, you get that company goes by, and you're tapping away again, the next company. And by the time you're in the middle of the battalion, you don't know what you're doing. You're tapping, and you're not in time with the movement. See, because they're getting out of your light. It's one of them little things you learn. So what you do is you beat a what they call a flam. Now a flam is you beat one with your left and just slightly after with the right. Ba-dum, ba-dum. See, and that kept you with the steps that went on. Because when I first went, I was completely up the creek. I used to think I knew it all on the drum. But when I was doing these parades on my own, it's surprising. You're humming a tune to yourself to try and beat out a rhythm to it, you know, and there's all these hundreds of feet going by there.
You told me that there was one occasion where you were asked to drum to break in some horses.
Oh, yes, that was Dara Dunn. Can you switch it off?
Okay.
Dara Dunn, wasn't it? Yes, I had to go across to this Indian regiment, report to the adjutant. And he told me to go wait for him on the square. And I stood out on the square, and the next thing I knew was about a dozen horsemen coming out, which were officers, British officers. And they encircled me, And the adjutant told me not to worry, just carry on tapping the drum, and they would close in on me. So I started tapping away. The next thing I knew, these horses were coming in, rearing up in the air. And he told me, carry on beating, don't stop, they won't hurt you. And I could feel their nostrils and the back of my neck. And I said, in the end, they got so close that I didn't seem to worry after that. So I started messing about and bashing the drum and swinging it round. The light was catching the horse's eyes. Next thing I knew was uproar coming from the camp lines. The lads were laughing their inside out, me hidden amongst all these horses, and they were sitting back laughing their heads off. But it went off okay. It's just one of those things.
These were new horses being brought
apparently,
in?
Apparently, they were young officers too, breaking them in. And it was the only time I'd done it. And he thanked me very much and said I was plucky. I don't know why. Why he should tell me I was plucky when he told me earlier on that I'd be quite okay.
When you call a leading tipper as a drummer?
Oh, drums. Well, a leading tipper is a solo drummer. You're not that you're senior, that more or less you're the best drummer at that particular time. So you become leading tipper or solo drummer. That is, you play the drum on your own. You play the solo parts by yourself. And the rest of the drums come in, the 40 parts. So it seems difficult to explain to somebody, say, that doesn't understand music, but they see there's 8 drums there, and you're beating on your own. That's called solo. And when the rest of the drums come in, the 8, that's 40. You're all banging together. It's difficult to explain, really.